Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniels, Tennessee Honey, and Cope Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Hi, we're Visible. We're the wireless company with nothing to hide. Seriously. Hidden fees? We don't have them. Annual contracts? Not our thing. Great wireless on just one line? Now that's more like it. Get unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon for just $25 a month. Taxes and fees included. That's right, $25 a month, every month. Sorry, hidden fees. We're just not that into you. Sometimes the choice is just Visible. Switch today at Visible.com. Rate with service on the Visible plan. For additional terms and network management practices, see Visible.com.
Hello, and welcome to the Long Form Podcast. I'm Aaron Lammer. I'm here with Evan Ratliff and Max Linsky. They are the co-hosts of this podcast, the Long Form Podcast.
Hello, Aaron.
Aaron, Evan, hello. Who's on the show?
On the show this week, I talked to Tessa Hulls. She is the author of Feeding Ghosts, which is a graphic memoir. It's graphic, but deeply, deeply researched book about her family, her mother, her grandmother, who escaped China, published a salacious memoir about that experience, and sort of how all of those threads carried down to her. She went to China. She got the book translated. So she had actually never read the book until she started working on this book. I have to say, I was really interested in how someone puts together a work like this, because unlike like most of the people on the show who are like working out of like a Google Doc or a Microsoft Word document and editors are going back and forth, certain parts of this sort of get hard coded as soon as you start drawing them. You can't have like a fact checker go back and then like change entire page layouts and stuff like that. So I'm always really interested in like the actual sort of nuts and bolts of production of this kind of nonfiction. And this was a really fascinating episode in that light.
Our show is brought to you in partnership with Vox. We thank them.
And now here's Aaron with Tessa Hulls.
Welcome to the Long Form Podcast, Tessa Hulls.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you wrote this book, Feeding Ghosts. It is a graphic memoir. It is one of the largest undertakings I can think of anyone who's been on this show, which includes people who have written like multi-volume books. So I want to get into like what it took from your life to produce this. But before we do that, I want to ask like what was going on with your life when you decided to undertake this project? Where were you at that point?
Well, I think decide is maybe the wrong word, because this project is the thing that I have spent my entire life running from. And I was incredibly determined to never touch this, either personally or professionally. So essentially, I grew up with the bones of this salacious true story in my family, knowing that my grandmother was a dissident journalist in China and, you know, something had broken her mind. And I kind of doubled down on a pathological amount of freedom. So I was running away, trying to not do this, like going to all seven continents by taking contract work. And the story finally caught up with me a couple months after my 30th birthday, when I was biking alone up a mountain in Mexico and sort of realizing that my free-flowing years of just pretending I wasn't being haunted by my family ghosts had come to an end, and I had to do this. So it was more a It was more an eventual act of resignation than a desire.
Okay, so people kind of understand like what the book is. Your grandmother was in China, had your mother, ended up fleeing China, wrote a best-selling, salacious memoir about the years, basically directly prior to having your mother. And then eventually your mother came to America with your grandmother, and your life unfolded from there. There's a lot more in there, but just to give some basic grounding. And I'm curious, like, knowing that this was sort of looming out there as a story, did you try like different ways of tackling this over time? Like, was this a story you attempted multiple times, or is this sort of your first shot at the story?
This was my first shot, because I knew that once I started, I was going to have to just stay in the current of this until I was done. So
yeah,
I knew that psychologically, I didn't really have the luxury of trying to do it in chunks, because for better or for worse, I am a very immersive worker. And I think that's why I've tried to kind of structure my life into seasonal benders, is I'm either, well, it's like Calvin and Hobbes. That's the trouble with tigers. There's no setting between high and off. And so also my background, I'm definitely not a traditional writer, and I've always been really multidisciplinary and work across half a dozen really disparate genres. And so for me, when I'm beginning a project, I let the story dictate the form that it wants to take. And I knew from the jump that I had to do this as a graphic novel, because it was the only way I was going to be able to cover the scale of the history, because it's basically a crash course in about a century of Chinese history that's not broadly known in the US, using my grandmother's life as a scaffolding. And if I tried to do that as a written book, it would be unbearably dense and academic. And also because so much of the narrative is looking at my grandmother's descent into what's externally seen as madness, but I question that a bit in the book. The story is really about, what does it mean for there to be multiple competing narratives and all of them to be true? And by doing that as a graphic novel, I could really show all of those braids simultaneously and force the viewer to join me in this choose your own adventure, where I don't think anyone can walk away from it thinking that there was one true story.
Yeah, that's, I think, a great summary of sort of the tension at the heart of the book. Knowing that that was going to be your sort of scaffolding, was this, it's your grandmother's history and the history of China. How did you figure out that balance as you went? Like, there's almost like actually like a sort of a breaking the fourth wall where you're sometimes like, this is getting a little heavy. Let me just talk about some of Mao's policies for a little bit. Like, where there is a, you can't just be in one of those narratives the whole time, that has to switch back and forth. You need both the context, but also I think kind of the rhythm of the pages is almost sort of dictated by that blend of the personal and the grand historical.
Yeah, definitely. And again, I think that's why I knew this had to be a graphic novel, because you basically, working in that medium, have the ability to take your viewer on these complete 180s and these huge jumps that you can't do if you're just working with words. And by throwing myself into the story as this narrator who's literally guiding the reader through history, like, I wander around through historical scenes and I point at things and I like call bullshit on stuff when I'm like, well, this is what the historical record says, but I don't think this is true. And I think I just had to feel that out organically, which is part of why this took me a decade. And there were sections of this book where I had parts that I knew were going to be in there, but I had no idea if they were going to be drawn, if they were going to be written, if I would use a primary document to illustrate it. And so I basically made an infinitely large analog, like, true crime detective wall, where I had all of these little scraps of paper and I gridded out the structure of the book and tried to do that balance visually, literally like with different colors, so that I could see, like, okay, I'm working with basically six timelines and then about eight recurring motifs, and I'm dancing through the present and the past throughout. And is this visually looking balanced? And that was the way that I tracked it. I should also say, I would not have been able, I really should have thanked Scrivener in my acknowledgments. And it's only because of listening to this podcast that I knew that Scrivener existed. And
sponsor the show, Scrivener. You heard it here first. I'm also a big Scrivener fan.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I literally would not have been able to do this without Scrivener, because my background before I started working on this was mostly as a painter. That was my most kind of established professional medium. So I, back before I became a compulsive genre hopper, I like made paintings and put them in galleries, and I did not have to be existentially torn when somebody asked me what I did for a living. And so basically the way that I work on a solo show is I get some phrase of text that lodges in my head, and then I have to make the body of work to understand what that means. And then I will make all the paintings simultaneously. So usually it's like 9 to 16 paintings. So it's pretty manageable to just painter's tape them to a wall, and I'll rotate through like maybe 4 or 5 of them in a day so that they all kind of cross the finish line simultaneously. And with making Feeding Ghosts, I did the exact same thing, only instead of a dozen pieces, there were almost 400. And I was also trying to weave in the material of having read over 100 books for research. And so Scrivener was how I made a digital studio big enough to accommodate holding all of those on the wall at the same time. And I kind of popcorned in the whole book by laying out the approximate amount of pages I thought I was going to need, and tracked them visually that way.
One of the things I was thinking about, I'm a pretty big graphic novel like fan historically. I would say I've like read a lot of graphic novels, but I have never thought about their production once. So you got 400 pages in your Scrivener. If you even like do a pencil sketch of all these pages, I feel like that's like a year of your life gone down. Like most of the people I have on this show have the luxury of being able to like write a textual rough draft and then keep improving upon it in the same document. At what point in your sort of editorial process are you first even like drawing? When do you give yourself the luxury of being able to start actually making these pages versus Scrivener lay them out?
I take umbrage at your word choice of luxury there. I calculated the surface area of all the drawings, and it was about 4,000 square feet, which to make that less abstract was about 18 elephants. And then the word count was about 60,000 words, which is high for a graphic novel.
Yeah.
But not when you're considering that I'm teaching a century of Chinese history and also following the life stories of three people.
Right.
But to loop back to your process question. So I didn't follow the traditional process where any sane graphic novelist working on something this long, they would sit down, they would write a script, they would get all of the structure figured out that way. Then they would go and draw thumbnails, get all the compositions and flow worked out.
Mm-hmm.
Then they would pencil it. And then the end process would just be inking all of those pencils. So I didn't do any of that. And my step one was to go live alone in the woods for half a year. And we can loop back on that later. But essentially, I wrote a 10,000 word written outline of the book. That was the armature of the whole thing. So it was making the little picture that goes on the front of the jigsaw puzzle. I got that really, really tight just as writing first.
Mm.
And the way that I found that was the book has 11 sections and each opens with an epigraph. And I think because as a visual artist, I've always started by having some phrase of text that I become obsessed with. That was how I found the structure of this book, is the epigraphs were the bones. And then I built out an outline from there. So once I had that 10,000 word outline, that's when I put that into Scrivener to figure out about how many pages I would need. And it wasn't like those lines would be a description of what would go on the page. It would literally be like, and here are the three pages in which I will explain the Cultural Revolution. And so then what I did is I printed out that whole Scrivener file. I put it in an analog 3-ring binder, and I would flip through that binder and I would try and find a page where I could figure out how that might want to become an actual drawn page. So that's what I mean, that I worked on the whole book simultaneously. And I think I drew for a year and a half before I had more than 3 pages. So my editor was basically, because she'd never worked on a graphic novel, didn't realize that I was doing something just unreasonably bonkers. And to her credit, just accepted it when I said, okay, leave me alone for a year and a half, and then maybe I can tell you what I'm doing. And so because there never was a thumbnail or pencil process, I just accepted that I was going to have to redraw some stuff, and made the decision after maybe the first 30 pages, that all of the text would be a digital layer. So I did actually have to change the structure of some of the transitions and just photoshopped it into smaller pieces to move some of the panels around. Mm. But once the book was done, the line edits happened in a Word doc. So it kind of was an act of constant translation between the words and the images. And there would be pages where I had drawn the whole thing, but still didn't know what the text would be. Mm. So like, if I look back on my drafts, there would just be text boxes where I'd left an approximate amount of space that would just be blah, 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 more intergenerational trauma, moving on. And then I would go back later and sort of figure out the nuances of how to state that. So the strength of this was that there was never a part of the book where I was just on autopilot producing it. And for a while in my Scrivener, there was a section called Don't Know, where it was pages that I knew went somewhere, but I didn't structurally know where they would go. And yeah, I eventually wove them all in, but I did have to redraw probably 30 pages. And there were definitely some pages that I had to kill some darlings.
I have like a gazillion questions about this for some reason. So I'm just going to, in no particular order. So when you're working, I think this is helpful for maybe people who are thinking about doing a work like this.
Don't do it.
You're working with an editor who's done this exactly as many times as you have, which is zero. And I'm assuming this is someone who has a lot of experience editing text-only books. Does that mean you're kind of primarily working on the text with your editor? Like, who's the drawing editor? Who's giving you feedback on the visual parts of the book? And also, like, how does one even think about like editing drawings? Like, does someone say, hey, I don't get this drawing, could you make this drawing more clear? Or like, what is the editorial process of pages rather than text like?
So there were no visual edits. Mm. My editor just basically said, I don't understand this world, but you seem to know what you're doing. So I'm just going to leave that in your camp. And I think I'm a pretty rigid self-editor who is good at jettisoning things. So mm-hmm. I think I had the requisite brutality to know when something needed to be redone or cut. But that's why I think for this particular project, choosing an editor was deeply important. And I was lucky that there was a lot of interest in it. So I did have a lot of options to choose from. And I ended up going with Daphne Durham at MCD because she seemed like the person who most recognized that I was trying to do something very genre-bendingly weird. And when I talked to publishers from traditional graphic novel presses, it was clear that they were going to try and make me work in a more traditional accepted format. And so it's funny, recently I found my notes from all those early editor interviews. And next to Daphne's name, you know, I had ranked them. And she was my first choice. And I had just written in all caps, not a linear thinker. And I knew that was what I needed in this project, was somebody who saw that I was raising my freak flag and would say, okay, go higher.
When you're pitching a graphic memoir, is your pitch graphic? Like, What are the materials for an editor to evaluate a book like this before it exists?
So my agent, Anjali Singh, she does represent a lot of graphic novels, and she's most known for having been the person to find and champion Persepolis. And so I wrote my proposal when I was living alone in the woods and just had her send me half a dozen examples. So I pitched with that 10,000 word outline and 16 drawn pages. And I think that was enough to give an editor the idea of what the drawn book would actually look like. But looking back at those first pages, I taught myself this form for this book. And so I had to do something that felt really vulnerable and exposing, which was, you know, here I am, this like very established painter. I have this muscle memory of being able to work with this fluidity in this one medium. And then I had to learn something new essentially in public for one project. And so like those first drawings from that proposal, I look back on them and I'm like, oh, it's the awkward middle school in braces phase. Like, how was that my haircut? And I think two of those pages made it into the actual book. And so the strength of the visuals definitely came as I was working on the project itself, because I didn't have that familiarity at the outset.
when you're picking up something brand new and you're doing something pretty massive with it, right? This isn't like, you know, toe dipping in the water with it. Like, what was your educational process of learning about graphic memoir production and laying out pages? Like, I don't even know, like, I'm even fascinated by like, how are things scanned in? Like, how does it go from your pen into the computer into like something that someone sees eventually?
I love that you're describing this almost in like Richard Scarry terms. You're like, how does the corncob car work? So it actually was really fun getting to teach myself the graphic novel medium as someone who is coming in fluent in other creative languages, because it's almost like being a painter and being an essayist. It's like speaking a romance language and then picking up another one where you're like, oh, I recognize so much of this territory. I understand the mechanics of how these conjugations work. And my favorite way to work is by just reading like a motherfucker. And so I live in Seattle, and every week I would go to the central library and I would just get a stack of graphic novels. And I wasn't going for ones that were, you know, kind of at that top echelon. I was like, I want to read widely. I want to see ones that don't necessarily work. I just want to cast a wide net understanding how people work in this format. And so I would go home and I would do little studio sketchbook critiques just for myself. And I would draw in the style, just a couple of panels of each of those to kind of understand the visual devices that each maker was using. So I just obsessively studied that way. And I think that's how I learned best, is by, you know, essentially following in the footsteps of people who have done this before, until you start to understand the mechanics of what they're doing and realize you're at a point where you can strike off on your own path.
Hi, we're Visible. We're the wireless company with nothing to hide. Seriously. Hidden fees? We don't have them. Annual contracts? Not our thing. Great wireless on just one line? Now that's more like it. Get unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon for just $25 a month. Taxes and fees included. That's right, $25 a month, every month. Sorry, hidden fees. We're just not that into you. Sometimes the choice is just Visible. Switch today at Visible.com. Rate with service on the Visible plan. For additional terms and network management practices, see Visible.com.
Calling all female runners, it's time to lace up and join Team Milk. Since the 2022 New York City Marathon, Team Milk has sponsored female marathon runners nationwide, providing support and shining a spotlight on their unique stories, perseverance, and drive to go the distance. Why milk? Dairy milk is an excellent nutritional add for both marathon training and recovery. Milk contains 13 essential nutrients, including high-quality protein, making it a crucial component of a training diet. Plus, it's one of the best beverages for hydration, even better than water. The same electrolytes that are added to many of your favorite sports drinks are found naturally in milk. And in 2024, Team Milk is taking the next step to empower female runners by launching the only women's marathon in the U.S. designed for and by women. Built to be accessible, empowering, and community-building, the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon will take place in Savannah, Georgia, on November 16, 2024. You can learn more and register for the marathon at everywomansmarathon.com.
When you started to put together the historical parts of the book, it's like the great leap forward. You've got 2 to 4 pages here. And this is a topic that literally you could write an entire book about, and a topic which is, I don't want to use the word controversial, but like there are differing truths about it. There are estimates of death tolls that range from, I think, 15 to 45 million. There's just a huge amount of subjectivity and possible interpretations that you're then massively cramming down, because those aren't 2 to 4 pages of text. That's like 4 pages with drawings. So you really have the equivalent of like 2 or 3 paragraphs to explain the Great Leap Forward. Tell me about that process, because not many people write extremely condensed history like that.
Yeah, it is definitely a skill set that I learned through this book. And I feel like it has caused me to work with an inhuman amount of concision that I really look forward to eventually getting to a project where I can like do the equivalent of manspreading and just take up like three seats and just be sloppy, which, let's be honest, I'm not constitutionally capable of that. But I think the way that I did that was, okay, what are the threads that can pull 10 times their weight in illustrating this for somebody? And I think that's where the ability to draw, you're right, I have to explain the Great Leap Forward probably in about 600 words. But in the space of a paragraph, I can draw something that can function as 5 pages if I can get the visual device right. Mm. And I think there's a synergy that happens when you compare the right image with the right sparse line of text, you can pull off something like that. And so to give an example, I talked about how essentially China's crusade of science denial was a mass hysteria. It was an entire country losing its mind. And that was deeply entwined with the more intricate story of how my grandmother's mind cracked and sort of ended up in a similar place of not knowing what was real. And I illustrated that by drawing Russian nesting dolls where, you know, the Mao layer is containing the grandmother layer. And that's something where you see that visually, you understand what I'm saying. And so I'm able to say that in probably literally 60 words.
When you flip to the other side of the book, which is your personal history, the story of your family, you have a lot of scenes where you're talking to your mother, or there's a portion of the book where you go back and sort of like revisit these places that are in your grandmother's memoir with your mother. How did you think about capturing those interactions? You know, normally people are quoting or maybe they're using a tape recorder. What did you see as sort of the essential process of converting what had been sort of your whole life's experiences, but you do a very specific turn, which is you're like, I'm writing a book about this. Like the writing of the book is a significant inciting incident in the book to get your mother to talk about these things, to sort of press on topics that have been off limits before. I'm curious about what those interactions were like while they were happening.
I think I used the same skill set that any journalist would, where you show up with a blank notebook, which is something that I can't remember what podcast guest of yours said that, but I heard that on Longform and that has always stuck with me. I think perhaps ironically, capturing those really subjective moments, especially when it's interpersonal conversations with my mother or aspects of my childhood, those were the areas where I leaned into maybe that journalistic practice the most, because I think that's how all of your muscle memory and your training and your understanding of how narrative works, you can find those key elements and those key scenes, even in something that's your own story, if you can take a bird's eye view on it. So I guess I didn't find that to be one of the challenging parts of this book. If anything, I would say it was the inverse, where a lot of the book is really about this process of, well, what does it mean to actually become too objective? What does it mean to disconnect from the emotional reality of what you've lived through? And how does that come to calcify and then fracture a mind? So in some ways, the writing of a book was this quest to destroy my own objectivity.
Were there specific mysteries or things you didn't know going into the book where you said, I need to find this out in order to do the book? Or was this sort of just like an open-ended inquiry of, I'm just going to look into this and whatever comes back, comes back? I mean, I believe at the beginning of the book, you haven't even actually read your grandmother's memoir because it hasn't been translated to English yet.
Yeah. So I don't think there was a possibility of me knowing what I didn't know. And going back to how I started this and that question of when did I begin making actual pages, I worked on this for 4 years before I wrote or drew a single thing. It was just doing the research because, you know, it required me to go on multiple international research trips to Hong Kong and China for months at a time. And I had to get grants to fund that and had to get a grant to fund the translation of my grandmother's memoir. And as I really started reading about this period of Chinese history, I just felt the floor falling out from underneath me as I began to appreciate the scale of what I was going to have to do. And I think sometimes when I feel afraid and daunted by a task, I lean into compulsive overreading. And so, yeah, it was 4 years of research and just essentially filling in my own vast ignorance about the context of this story before I even started trying to tackle the personal side.
Taking on a project of this scale, which is you're selling a book, but you also need grants, you need translators. How did you feel comfortable like putting so much of your life into one thing? Like there must have been a thought, oh, I could do a, you know, a 30-page comic about this, or I could do like a test run. Like what inspired you to go this hard on this and to dedicate so many years? How did you know that you needed this much, not some sort of a, you know, compromise between this and a slightly like lighter approach to it?
I've always found it interesting reading memoirs by people who clearly started the project just a little bit too young, where they're amazing, but you can tell that there's a place they haven't reached yet. And it's maybe this place of being willing to attack your idols, or willing to see the ways in which you are complicit in the story you're trying to tell. And for me, I started this book a couple months past my 30th birthday, and I don't think that it's coincidence that, you know, I hit what was this kind of life marker point. And I would say grudgingly, but also with a sense of enormous purpose, said, okay, I'm ready. I think I have done what I needed to have the skill set to survive where this is going to take me. And it was always done from that place of, this is going to be so unbearably large that it is going to take every ounce of me to pull this off. And I have to see this through, which honestly, I think I'm still recovering from the aftermath of that. But there's a way in which, for me, that question of what does it mean to be the daughter of immigrants, where you do have this deeply embedded sense of duty to these stories that you are shaped by, and the understanding that you've been given a life with so many more options than your parents. I think that sense of duty and that awareness of privilege was what allowed me to be able to say, okay, I will give this everything for as long as it takes.
I sort of looked through some of the things that you've done before writing this book, and they involve like thousands of miles of bike riding, or like going and living in a cabin by yourself for a really long time. It seems like you're almost attracted to a certain extremity in pursuit of everything. Tell me about that, like over the course of your life, and how it played into you doing this book.
Yeah, I think that's definitely my nature. Part of that is maybe growing up in a town of 350, I got really comfortable being alone at a very young age and just basically spent my childhood wandering around through the hills with a backpack full of books. And maybe that sense of growing up next to all of this wild, untrammeled space sunk into my bones on a visceral level, because I am somebody who has always been deeply drawn to frontiers. And they're the places where I feel the most curiosity and the most refuge. And yeah, it's just how I'm wired. I mean, I'm an experiential learner. So I would say I first kind of went rogue. I went on a 5,000 mile bike ride from Southern California to Maine. And I did it solo. And, you know, prior to that, I had never biked more than 35 miles, and I'd never gone on a bike camping trip. But I learned by doing, and I know that that's how I do best, is I throw myself in the deep end of something and learn on the way.
When you were living in this cabin in isolation, working on the book, what were you thinking about every day? What was your mental process without any sort of external markers of time, without like a normal social life when you were completely sort of like inwardly focused on this book. For people who've never done something like that and probably won't ever do something like that, like, what does that do to your creative process when it's basically the only thing in your life?
It does the opposite of making you inwardly focus. Mm. It makes yourself dissolve. It gave me the experience of truly becoming an animal. And I think it turned me feral in a way that I never actually came back from. And just to provide some context as to what I was doing out there. So there's this very unique writing residency called the Penn Northwest Marjorie Davis Boyden Wilderness Writing Residency. And for over 30 years now, it offers the opportunity for one writer to experiment with extreme solitude. And so if you get this residency, you are given a cabin in the Rogue River Wilderness in Southern Oregon. And there's no cell service. There's no continuous electricity. There's one small solar panel so you can keep a laptop charged. And there's a radio phone that's a party line with the whole valley so that you can use in emergencies. And when you apply, which you have to do via snail mail in triplicate, and you also have to do a site visit the year before because they really want their writers to understand what they're getting themselves in for, because it's a 2-hour drive on remote logging roads to get to the nearest town. And you have to be willing to use a chainsaw because if trees fall on the road, nobody's going to come clear them for you. So you have to be comfortable with self-reliance. And I became friends with the brothers who run this thing. And they say that they're really trying to weed out people who have a romantic notion of solitude, but no experience with it. So basically the application is a, what have you done that makes you able to thrive in this situation? And so for me, I think that characteristic that many visual artists and performance artists have, where you start establishing acts of repetition, which I tend to think of as acts of devotion. I hiked to the river every day and I stared at the river and I didn't think about much and I just watched it. And I was growing all of my own food because I wanted to leave as little as was humanly possible. So I was really just taking care of this land that I found myself on. I had 94 acres and a couple miles of trail. So I was just repairing things and tending things and watching the light change color in the meadow. And I think that's why this book became what it did, is because I was making it in a state where I was the opposite of inwardly focused. And I was able to just treat the story like a landscape and be in it and explore it without any outside pressures or distractions. And so I decided I was going to go on a complete media diet. So I wasn't going to consume anything. And I made two exceptions. And one was I had a friend load up an external hard drive of high school romantic comedies in Mandarin so that I could work on my Chinese. So I would like sit on the porch of this remote cabin and watch the show Meteor Garden. And it was just like ridiculous to have like these, you know, towering madrones and sugar pines and like dead silence in the wilderness. And then this like melodramatic.
I'm particularly enjoying this anecdote because this means that Meteor Garden is going into the show notes of this episode. And someone's going to find Meteor Garden this way.
Wonderful, wonderful. I also learned that that Chinese TV shows have like 80 episodes to a season. It's very different. So they really lean into the drama. And then my only other exception was that I would listen to the entire back archive of long form. And initially I was going to start listening at the beginning and go through sequentially, but as I'm sure you all know, you became much better interviewers.
So, plus the first 50 have like terrible sound quality. So it's really a bad place to start. If you're listening to this, start at like maybe 100 at minimum.
I don't know. I think you should give yourselves a bit more credit than that. But I ended up popcorning around at random. And I remember the moment at which I knew that like the one thing I wanted when this book came out was to go on the long form podcast, was because I was listening to the episode with Cheryl Strayed and she was talking about this experience of being on the PCT and how nobody got that level of solitude anymore. And I remember at that point when I was listening to it, I was like out in the middle of nowhere with a shovel, digging water bars, doing trail work with my dog. And I just remember like saying aloud, like, that's not true. and thinking that at some weird point in the future, when this book actually came out in the world, this podcast taught me so much about the craft and business and honestly, ethical considerations of being a nonfiction writer that I wanted to close this loop and bring it full circle.
That makes me so happy. I love any anecdote about listening to the show that isn't, I was listening to it when I was a freshman on the high school newspaper, and now I'm a professional journalist. Those ones make me feel very old. This anecdote makes me feel like there's been a value to creating this archive. So thank you for that. So wait, were you listening on like local copies? There's no reception. So you just had a download of the podcast?
Yeah. So the nearest town was Grants Pass, Oregon. And so once a month I would leave to go check mail and restock on perishables. So I would go to the Grants Pass library and I would download another chunk of long form kind of at random. And at first I was really methodical about, okay, I'm going to like make this spreadsheet and I'm going to like write down all the ones I listened to. And I'm going to put like my takeaway of like kernels of wisdom. And it was actually an interesting and like somewhat heartbreaking realization where in some ways I think being a long form magazine writer would have been the perfect path for me as somebody who loves to do these 3 to 9 month deep dives and become focused on talking to really interesting people about some hyper-specific thing, and then you move on. And so in a way, listening to the entire back archive was this emotional journey for me of being like, oh, in a different life, with a different unfolding of time, I think that's what I would have wanted to do.
What was it like when you came back? What was like your experience of the world after this?
I don't think I ever fully came back. And it's interesting because the timeline on this, so this was in 2019. I was in there from April to November. And my friend and I had a timeshare dog. I'm not going to try and explain that too deeply, but basically the dog that I had out there, I had to leave Southern Oregon and drive straight to Mexico to bring her back to her other season, where my friend was running a marine biology research station on the Sea of Cortez. And so I had to leave the woods, drive immediately to Mexico, and had this high... had this high stakes book auction happen as I was driving to Mexico. And I remember pulling over by the side of the road in a field full of oil derricks where I happened to have a patch of cell service and trying to get my dog to drink water out of a yogurt container as I'm looking at my phone, realizing that my life has fundamentally changed. And I took probably a month to eventually backpack and road trip my way back up to the Northwest where I live. And at that point I was living in Port Townsend. And then was immediately staring down the barrel of a tight and daunting publication deadline. So I sold the book in January of 2020, essentially, and then COVID hit. So
it's just incredible luck that you went out into the woods directly before COVID.
Well, so
you wish you could slightly change the timeline.
Honestly, I think that's part of why this process was so personally eviscerating is, you know, I kind of accidentally been residency hopping for a year before I went into the woods because I had cast a wide net with my first round of residency applications because I'd never done that before and so didn't know what my success rate would be. And then when I got all of them, they were perfectly timed so that I could just go from like back-to-back residency working on this book. And so when I left the woods, I strode out so clear and so full of purpose. And I knew that the part of my life that really needed care and maintenance was reestablishing deep human ties and being part of community. And I was like coming back being like potlucks and playing, like just being in people. And then COVID hit and I had to spend all of it just alone in a room drawing my crying mother. And it got pretty bleak, I'm not going to lie.
I don't know that this is ever explicitly said in the book, but I definitely got the feeling that your family would have preferred you like not write this book or at least not open up some of the doors in the hallway that this book opens up. How did you manage like sort of what this book meant for other people and what were your considerations for like the other people who are in this book who are real people?
I think because the book essentially focuses on three main characters and it's just me, my mom, and my grandma. And my grandma's dead. My mom is a strangely atypical immigrant parent who actually really wanted to talk about all the darkness. So she was incredibly supportive. She really wanted to see this happen. And there was definitely a lot of fear from my family who still live in mainland China. And the way that I handled that was by following my grandmother's lead and how she wrote her book, by not using their names, by removing identifying details, and really trying to protect them. So, you know, I think I kept things vague where I could. And it's funny that the first comment I got from the 10,000 word outline from both my editor and my agent was, "So where are all the men?" And I basically said, you know, I just followed the lines of who ended up taking responsibility, and that became its own answer. So in some ways, I think because the story of my family is such a story of severed ties and isolation, it made my job pretty easy, because sticking to the bones of the story, there really weren't very many people. It was a really tragic investigation into what happens when trauma essentially takes you away from the ability to belong. But it removed a lot of those ethical quandaries, because there weren't people to protect, because there were no people.
Does the Chinese government care about some Americans' graphic memoir? How big a thing does it have to be to where the government is not happy about it?
My book's definitely going to be a banned book in China. That's okay. A given. And we actually couldn't print it in China, because you can't print material that is critical of the Communist Party on a Chinese press. And I imagine that the mainland Chinese response to it is to ignore it. But I also think that I will get torn apart by mainland Chinese internet, and in all likelihood, I'll never be given a visa again. But I'm really not sure, to be honest. One thing that was really interesting is when I was in Hong Kong doing research for this trip, I connected with a journalist from the South China Morning Post, and she ended up doing a story on the book. And as part of that, we were kind of going back and forth between what do you guys have in your archives? And I discovered that my grandmother, who, you know, died in a town in Northern California with a population of 350, for some reason, the South China Morning Post already had in their archives a copy of her obituary from this small town newspaper. And so the fact that all of these decades later, somebody was still to some extent keeping tabs on her, I think that's the thing with so much of what's happening in China, is the level of surveillance and the level of control of narrative seems so unbelievable on a superficial level that it's easy to dismiss the extent of it. But it's pretty extraordinary how far that reaches. And the book did sell in Taiwan, so there is going to be a Chinese translation. And I don't know how that's going to go. I wish I could answer that question, because it's a question that I have too.
When you were in China, you know, asking questions, knocking on doors, looking in archives, what kind of responses did you get from the people you were asking, you know, whose doors you were knocking on, the archives you were going in? And how much did you explain of what your project was and the potentially volatile parts of it?
So I would say most of my research was actually in Hong Kong rather than China, because one of the conflicted benefits of a colonial government is that the records there were in English. And there also wasn't the same push to deny so much of the past. And, you know, unfortunately, my mom didn't teach me Chinese when I was a kid. I've fought my way back to some small amount of Mandarin, but I can't read Chinese. And in terms of deciphering handwritten archives, it's just not going to happen. I'm not at that level. So I think with China, that part of the story, because my mom and grandma fled just before the Great Leap Forward, most of the information that I was trying to find on an archival level was actually during that time period in Hong Kong, you know, looking into trying to find medical records from Castle Peak, the mental institution that my grandma was committed to, stuff like that. And I think because of that distance of being in Hong Kong, there wasn't a lot of suspicion or pushback or fear. But I did have some journalists that I met there really kind of put me in my place and cautioned me, because I went over there, like kind of as you framed it, as this American with a copy of my grandmother's book, saying, "Oh, look at this really interesting historical artifact." And I was over there at a point where the booksellers incident had just happened. There was this new atmosphere of control of publishing, where Beijing was just starting its overreach on those levels when I was in Hong Kong. And I remember someone there telling me, you know, when you go to the mainland and they're x-raying your bags, what they're looking for is books. And you need to be careful with this, because for you, it's the past, but for here, it's the present.
For you, now that you've put like most of a decade of your life into this, what excites you creatively going forward? Would you do another project like this ever? It's like, once you've done it once, it's like kind of exhausted.
This book forced me into a way of making that felt really at odds with how I know I move through the world, both as a maker and a person. And a lot of how I work is based on spending a lot of time staring at remote landscapes. And so I've spent a lot of time up in Alaska, and I'm really fascinated by braided river bars right now. So you get these wide valleys and the water spreads out in these alluvial fans. So the water has all of these broad channels that take up a huge amount of horizontal space. And I think for me, having always been a really multidisciplinary artist, I think of each medium as a different channel of a river. And that is how I need to work. But this book, it was a cataract. It, like, everything had to go into this one flow. And it felt really erosive in a way that I think I'm coming back from. So right now, I think I'm really interested in getting back to a relationship with making that is that multidisciplinary meandering route. And I'm not sure what that looks like yet, but I definitely learned through doing this project that I am not a creature of book-length endeavors. I think because I do sprint when I'm working, and for better or for worse, can't help but put everything into it, that's a pace I can really only sustain for 3 to 9 months. And that was my cadence before this. And I think it's the cadence that I want to get back to.
Speaking again about sort of the difference between like writing practices and studio art practices, do you feel like you want to reuse the skills that you've built making this book, like learning about laying out pages and outlining all the stuff? Or is part of the nature of this that it's a one-time sand painting on the ground that gets whisked away and you don't revisit it?
That's a good question. And I think I would probably have a different answer in 6 months.
Okay.
Right now, I'm very much throw it all in the fire and let the ashes disperse to the wind. I do think that the concision that I learned for this project and the ability to now be like, oh yeah, I can explain the Cultural Revolution in 3 pages. There are instances in which I will draw on that, but I've always been a creature of seasonality and I need a break from this season of making.
Tessa, thank you so much for this interview. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much for indulging my very idiosyncratic wish.
That was the Long Form Podcast. Thanks very much to Tessa Hulls, my guest. Thanks to Evan Ratliff and Max Linsky. They're my co-hosts. Thanks to Jackie Sajiko, who edited this episode. Thanks to Megan Valley for doing the show notes. Thanks to everyone over at Vox. Thanks to everyone who listens to this show, including people who listen to it on local copies from an off-grid cabin. We appreciate all of you, and we'll be back with a new episode next week.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within Art, Beats, and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Hi, we're Visible. We're the wireless company with nothing to hide. Seriously. Hidden fees? We don't have them. Annual contracts? Not our thing. Great wireless on just one line? Now that's more like it. Get unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon for just $25 a month. Taxes and fees included. That's right, $25 a month, every month. Sorry, hidden fees. We're just not that into you. Sometimes the choice is just Visible. Switch today at Visible.com. Rate with service on the Visible plan. For additional terms and network management practices, see Visible.com.